Thanks, everyone. Thanks for coming tonight. We'll be with Congressman McCaul momentarily. It's funny, behind the scenes, we like to give listeners to come out on a snowy, difficult night, a little bit behind the scenes. He stepped into the men's room just before we were introduced to come out. But I expect tonight to have a great time with him. He's fresh off the Bill Maher show. And he told me in the green room that Bill Maher actually gave him a high five. Now, Bill Maher is, shall we say, not on our list of favorite people, but when it comes to national security, he certainly is a guy that recognizes Congressman McCaul and what Congressman McCaul has put together. I'm not sure how much you've been able to leaf through the book or heard me talk about it, but it is as interesting, as riveting, and frightening. It's not bedtime reading, so don't read it before you go to bed tonight. You might be tossing and turning. And what I plan to do is talk with him about various aspects of the book, but call upon him to talk about national security in general. The book right now is number one on Amazon as we speak when it comes to national security. So let's welcome to Philadelphia, Congressman Mike McCaul. Thanks, Congressman. Yeah, over there. Well, Congressman, I was just talking about back in the green room, we were talking about Bill Maher is a fan of yours. And you know talk radio, you do more talk. First of all, doesn't the Congressman look, those of you that have seen him on TV, much better in person with a round of applause?
Wow. Yes,
no, that's a better thing. That on TV, he's kind of the, I know when I'm sitting in the Barco Lounge with DJ and Luke watching him, particularly DJ is a big fan. Here comes the frightening guy, because they call you, there's a serious Chris Wallace, tell us today what the heck is going to happen to us, aspect of this. And the congressman, through his dad, you'll read in the foreword of the book, has come up with an interesting way of presenting this, you'll read in the book, these probable scenarios told in an interesting, almost novel form, and then an after intelligence report of what would happen. I might say, as a layman, I think you even don't scare us enough in some of these. They might even be worse. Followed by your solution to what we could do to prevent this. So I thought I'd ask you, what keeps you up at night? You get the same briefing as President Obama, who is in denial on this. What keeps you up at night? Because you're not. You believe that this stuff can happen.
Yeah. Well, first, let me say thanks for having me. Here to the historical city, I was a history major. Real honor to be here. Thanks, everybody, for being here tonight. If I could just say, I put everything that keeps me up at night in this book, for the most part. And I did it for one simple reason. Not for me, because it's not about me. Mm-hmm. Not for money, because I'm donating all the proceeds to wounded warriors and their children. But I did it because of the counter-narrative, to be a counter-narrative to the administration. I think the false narrative coming out of this administration about the threat level has done a real disservice to the American people. And I wanted the American people to really understand the true nature of the threats that we face as a nation. As you mentioned, I get similar briefings.
Take me through the briefing, if you can. Are you in some cone? Is there a cone of silence? Is there a place you go?
Yeah, I have a classified briefing room.
And who talks to you? Who briefs you?
I have a classified briefing room in the Capitol.
Okay.
On a weekly basis, sometimes daily. I have, you know, the FBI, Homeland Security, National Counterterrorism Center, and the intelligence community come in to brief me about the latest threats. And sometimes you walk out thinking, oh my God, you know. You have to compartmentalize the information. But when I see the president, you know, say that Fort Hood was workplace violence or Benghazi was a video, or, you know, even at the State of the Union, say that that ISIS is not an existential threat to the United States, it bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
Because his rhetoric doesn't meet reality. And I think it's because it's his campaign narrative of ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, shutting down Guantanamo, and then ISIS popped up, and he can't really explain.
JV team.
The JV team.
Right.
You know, he declared the war on terror over the same week Baghdadi declared the caliphate. So I've seen this consistent, you know, attempt to downgrade it. And so I wanted a book that told the American people the truth about the threats we face as a nation. Now, I have fictional scenarios that are put in there to really get the interest of the reader.
Mm-hmm.
But then, could it really happen? That's more based, designed, fact-based, to educate the American people and the policymakers. Many members of Congress, believe it or not, don't understand all this, about what the threats really are. And then finally, in a constructive way, what can we do to prevent future acts of terror?
I take from the book the overall thing, too. It's not a question of resources. We can always have more resources. It's what you said. Even people in Congress just can't bring themselves to the fact that we have people that want to murder us and murder our kids, and they are effective in the sense that they're getting people through technology and the perverted form of this religion, and people in the media who refuse. You're here in Philadelphia, where we had a mayor where a guy says, ISIS inspired me to shoot this police officer, and he tells us that religion had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. I don't, you know, look, I think we have to call it what it is, define it to defeat it,
mm-hmm.
and until we defeat it, it's going to continue to be a threat. And I think, you know, this political correctness about not calling it what it is, I don't quite understand that. And I think it does a grave disservice when I read about what they're doing and the graphic videos. My God, if that doesn't get your attention.
Mm-hmm.
The radicalization over the internet, these 200,000 ISIS tweets per day that come out of Raqqa, Syria to radicalize individuals globally. This is mm-hmm. a global phenomenon. We have 35,000 foreign fighters from 120 different countries converging into Iraq and Syria. They're also going into Libya now mm-hmm. in an attempt to advance this caliphate idea. And their external operations are getting more sophisticated. We saw Paris, very sophisticated. We don't want to see that happen in New York. We have stopped a lot of bad things, Dom, from happening. I can tell you that. And we've had 80 ISIS-related arrests. That's more than one per week. So we're doing a pretty darn good job. The FBI has done a pretty darn good job trying to stop mm-hmm. all this, but it's overwhelming. And the chatter is so high and the volume is so high, it's hard to stop it all.
Well, let's go through the book, and people here may or may not have heard me talk about some of these in our promo. One that we played, we talked about smallpox, the most chilling to me, at the Magic Kingdom. And it had to be difficult for you to write this because, you know, you don't want to do this, bringing this type of issue down on Disney. But the fact that if these terrorists could get smallpox, they could infect a couple people. Those little air fans whirling around, they could infect thousands of people potentially. There's an incubation period, and they go all over the country, if not all over the world, spreading that. We don't have people vaccinated against smallpox already. So why did you bring Disney into this? Why did you do that?
You know, I wanted to bring in all different threats from different countries to different parts of the United States. So I picked Iran for the dirty bomb. I picked mm-hmm. Putin and Russia, and I picked China and North Korea for cyber security. I picked, obviously, you know, al-Shabaab with the Mall of America
mm-hmm.
and al-Qaeda and ISIS for the attack on the Capitol in the first chapter. That was a tough one. I have five teenagers, right? So I have my own homeland security issues at home.
Mm-hmm.
I call them domestic terrorists. But that was a hard one because it does involve children. But the fact is that right after 9/11, is it fact-based? Yes. There was an exercise. You know, there are red team exercises that we run in the military and the intelligence community. And we do it for a reason. We think about things like this. And then how can we stop it? So this book is essentially a red team exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an exercise called Dark Winter, done right after 9/11 on smallpox. And we found that millions of Americans would be infected and they would die. Smallpox has killed 300 million people in the world over time. It's been eradicated, but we have an entire population that has not been inoculated. And so if it gets out of Russia, which it suggests in the book that it mm-hmm. has proliferated, that the potential of this could be very widespread. Why Disney World? Because people from all over the world go there.
Mm-hmm.
And it would go back to places all over the world. Would have the maximum impact for infection. Bioterror is an odd one. It's a threat you can't see. So when Ebola hit my home state, and there were only a handful of cases, I can't tell you the terror that that spread throughout my state and the country, because you didn't know where mm-hmm. it was.
Well, let me jazz with you what these guys tell me. Obama doesn't tell me it, but the people I get on locally or whatever, we're fearmongers. Look, they control Ebola, despite people dying and the fear around that. So why get so upset? We can deal with this. If smallpox hit, Ebola hit, they dealt with it. That's it.
Well, and that's why, what can we do to stop it? We have to stockpile right. the vaccine. Right. We have to deal with the sensor technology. There are ways to prevent this, but if we don't imagine it, then it's what the 9/11 Commission talked about. That's the title of the book, was we failed to imagine airplanes being turned into cruise missiles and mm-hmm. flying into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and mm-hmm. they tried to get the Capitol. Now, who would have thought that at the time? I can take you back to the history of Ranzi Youssef, 93 World mm-hmm. Trade Center bombers, his uncle Khalid Sheikh right. Mohammed, that whole deal. They were talking about airplanes back then, but we had a failure, and we can't afford to have another failure.
Well, let's talk about one of those, too, an insight that I didn't know that you emphasized in the very first chapter, decapitating Congress, taking out Congress. These guys like to repeat and go back to it. I thought that was something, the criminal always returns to the scene of the crime, and all you only see in TV movies. But you go into the very first chapter talking about the return, unfinished business, because they were going to hit the Congress on 9/11.
Yeah, it was pretty clear they were headed towards the Capitol, and they do like to return to their targets. I mean, World Trade Center is a classic example of that. And I believe the Capitol, you had the gyrocopter. Thank God that was literally a guy that went postal. You had a drone, small drones, with explosives like the first chapter, an attempt. You had a guy with pipe bombs out of Ohio with AK-47s that wanted to kill members of Congress. This is not something I'm making up to scare people. It's happened, and we've stopped it, but we have to be prepared for it. And they do like to return to their targets.
Well, let's talk about this then and some of the issues that come up. We've hit one, the denial of the administration on this. That's the overarching theme to your book, that you talk about it openly. Let's talk about this PC stuff, though, too, and how that can be fought, about the people that are being radicalized, how they're being radicalized. What is it that's going on in Congress? And, you know, when you talk in the media, you don't seem to get savaged when you bring these things up. So what's the McCall secret? They don't seem to vilify you as the way they may a talk radio host or some other people out there, even in the presidential race right now, that speak out about this, Syrian refugees, all these things that I know listeners that are here tonight have told me they're really concerned about this. And these are not bigoted people, but they're fearful of a certain significant element around the world that is engaged in using religion as part of this process.
Well, I think when I go across the country on this book tour or mm-hmm. back home, I think the general feeling is Americans don't feel as safe. Mm-hmm. If it could happen in Chattanooga or San Bernardino, it can happen anywhere, anytime, any place. You're right, Bill Maher show, I had a little trepidation going on there. He's smart, and he can't go on the attack. Ended up with a high five. I think he agreed with my message because I try to present it in a rational, intelligent, thoughtful way that doesn't open it up to the critics. And I know I have credibility in terms of what I'm talking about, and I don't mm-hmm. think people can second guess that because they know I get the briefings. And so, again, the book is really an attempt to tell the American people the truth about the threats we face as a nation, what we need to do to stop.
Let me ask you a question.
And I think it's just, people are really hungry for this.
I'm not sure if you get too often, though. President Obama, do you ever have a chance, would you ever go to the Oval Office? Smart guy. I'm not one of those that think he's incompetent. I just think he's ideological beyond belief. And sit there and talk with him and try to pick apart this so that somehow or another we breach this. Is that just not doable, given the ability of esteem that you have as the expert by anybody, and a reasonable guy with him?
He, it's unfortunate that he has decided to take the more isolated approach. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a more insular president who does not want to engage the Congress, and he's made a calculated determination to do that. Secretary Jay Johnson of Homeland Security, in contrast, I have to say, in fairness, calls me on a routine basis. You know, had dinner with him. Mm-hmm. You know, I consider him a friend. I would argue if Obama had that style and approach, he'd be far more successful. You know, Clinton, I disagree with him, but he engaged the Congress, you know. Mm-hmm. And most successful presidents engage the Congress. They don't run away from the Congress.
So he does get the same level that you do, but he just sees it differently, and engaging you might be just wasted time. He's solidified in what the narrative is.
I don't know if it's a lack of interest or just doesn't fit his campaign narrative that he ran on in the first place. As you and I talked about, it was a failure. Look, we made plenty of mistakes in the Bush administration on Iraq, but we did stabilize it, and we left it stabilized, and we didn't have a status of forces agreement that Condi Rice told me we handed off to the Obama administration, and the total failure to engage with Prime Minister Maliki. Mrs. Clinton went there one day for 3 hours. It politically collapsed between the Sunni and Shia in Iraq. You had an implosion in Iraq, and out of the ashes came, formerly al-Qaeda in Iraq, became ISIS, Sunni extremists. That's the formation of ISIS today. And when that happened, and I was getting briefed on this probably a year and a half before it was public, and I kept seeing the threat level go up and up and up. And I just don't think he can get his head wrapped around it. I don't think he wants to, and he would rather put his head in the sand. But you can't pretend like it doesn't exist, and you have to deal with it.
Now, you mentioned Mrs. Clinton. Does it surprise you what we're seeing play out, given the level of how careful you are with classified, even when I see you on TV talking about it? You could break it down for laymen, the people that are here tonight. We're partisan, you know, on this. There's a history here. But that aside, it seems pretty clear to me. We shared admiration of General Petraeus, and Petraeus has paid dearly, and rightfully so. As much as I admire him, he's a hero to me. And yet it seems to be a very similar thing going on here with this server as this is playing out. So is your sense that the FBI can act in a rational way and come to a conclusion about this, or is it so politicized that you just can't break through that?
Well, I mean, you know, I live in the classified world. I have to treat it
right
properly. I can't bring my iPhone into that room. And if I sent emails out afterwards pertaining to that information, I would be prosecuted. And so, you know, look, I have a lot of confidence in Director Comey.
I do, too.
I've known him for a long time, even, you know, when I was a federal prosecutor. He's has a lot of integrity. The question is, what is DOJ going to do with it when it's handed? I worked in the public integrity section for a long time, and very thorough indictment review process. You like to think politics are not involved, but, you know.
We'll is there any scenario where the FBI would decide this? I read of things the last week or so where there are more, there are things that they could do to push the envelope if they hand it to, other than resign. What could they do?
Well, you know, I don't know. The FBI is always to be feared to some extent. I mean, they can leak certain information to make their point if they want to.
Gotcha. I'm writing that one down. Let's go back to your book, Congressman. Let's talk about, in addition to what we've talked about, that you use the Port of Houston. I've been using on the air the Port of Philadelphia since we're two blocks away and you stayed at a hotel. Yeah. The dirty bomb scenario, which seems, again, to be within the reach of these guys, very probable, not something of a thermonuclear and all that stuff that North Korea has, but something, talk about the dirty bomb. What is that, and why would that be doable in a port?
Well, because it's the easiest. We talk a lot about weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. In ISIS's latest publication, they talk about getting a Pakistani nuclear device and smuggling that through transnational criminal organizations into the Western Hemisphere and then across the U.S.
You mentioned Venezuela in the book.
And there's a Venezuela-Iran connection. It's a Tehran-Caracas where these aero-terror flights fly without it. We can't check the manifests on these flights. Mm-hmm. So it's been long known in law enforcement intelligence circles. We don't know what's coming in. It's, you know, in Homeland Security, it's all about people and things and keeping bad people and bad things out of the United States. In this case, I talked about the Iran deal, spent fuel coming through a stick of dynamite. You know, a nuclear device would be even far more devastating, obviously. But, it, you know, spent fuel in a backpack through the points of entry with the stick of dynamite at the port where most of the energy supply comes through to the nation. That contamination would shut down that port for a long time. And it's something I worry about, you know, in my state. And it goes to the security of the border as well.
The security of the border, since we're on that too, and you're a guy, again, that's buttoned up on this type of stuff. I've been to the border, you've lived it though, and have seen it, and where I was, they had done a heck of a job in El Paso. I mean, it was very difficult. We rode with these guys to get in. I think they only arrested three people that day because you couldn't get in. Yet we still have these vast stretches. Is it undoable, or we just don't want to do it?
I think it's, you know, I have a bill in the Congress. I hope we can pass it. We can get it done. We need the political will to do it. You know, you're right. El Paso did something called Hold the Line, and they secured it. But it's between ports of entry that the vulnerability exists. I think, you know, technology assets from theater of war to have 100% visibility so you can see what's happening. If you can see the threats, you can stop the threats. Right now, we can't see them, and therefore, we can't stop them. Last time I was in Afghanistan, I was with General Allen, and these aerostats are in the sky, and I said, what's that? He said, well, that's our border security. What are you going to do with that when we withdraw? Well, we're going to leave them here. Can we bring some of those back to the United States? So now we have 15 aerostats down on the southwest border, but we have a lot more, you know, work to do.
And you talk about the Canadian border. It's not just Molson and hockey players coming in. The Canadian border is it 1,934 miles or something? I seem to memorize that. The number's sticking in my head,
Canada,
something like that.
And we do. We talk about southern all the time. The Canadian is real easy. And there's a connection between ISIS, and there are a lot of Algerians and French ISIS. That's how they attack Paris. You see a lot of ISIS influence in the UK. And so when you look at Canada, it has that UK-French connection to it, and the ease with which they could travel to Canada and New York, where I just came from this morning, being so close in proximity to hit. And that was actually the first chapter was going to be a hit on New York, but we picked the capital, but it could be any place, you know, along that border.
Let's talk about some of the other threats out there. We, in the green room, had some people talking with you about, we've just been through a snowstorm here. You're in Washington. All the transplants to Washington are amazed that an inch of snow in the world goes here. Here it's French toast. I heard Rich Zioli, our afternoon host, talking about the French toast complex here, and the salt complex to sell it, the mania that happens. So if we had a cyber strike of any sort, financially, power particularly, my God, New York, when they had the blackout, you know, it was mayhem. Talk about that threat that you talk about in the book, and that seems to be where a lot of people are warning. Ted Koppel and others have had books out, Richard Clark, they're very much on top of this. And that seems to be a resource and attention to it, that this could be thwarted, but maybe we're not doing it that well.
Well, Clark and I collaborate on the cyber chapter in the book. NSA Director Keith Alexander and I talked about quantum computing, which is going to be the next generation. Whatever country gets this is going to, you know, it's like the atomic bomb. It's like going from the abacus to the computer exponentially. And so I talked about the vulnerability of the power grid, say, in the Northeast, getting shut down. You just had a major snowstorm shut down, you know, the city for maybe a day. Imagine that happening for weeks, if not months. The capability is there today. The cyber warfare capability, we have great offensive capability to shut things down. It also involves an attack on the New York Stock Exchange, which would cause utter financial chaos. And I bring these illustrations up because we have to be prepared to stop them. You have Russia that steals intellectual property. So the Target, Home Depot, credit card theft, organized criminal sort of mafia Russian stuff. You had the Chinese steal 20 million security clearances in the federal government, greatest act of espionage. North Korea shut down Sony Pictures in a highly destructive
caused a lot of attack. Hollywood stuff, too, that was pretty interesting.
And it got their attention. And it got Hollywood's attention.
Exactly.
And then you had, finally, Iran's been pinging the financial sector, primarily over the sanctions, but they've been hitting the financial. And then we have jihadists that are now exploring, and, hey, we can buy this stuff, malware.
Right.
And so it's real. We talk a lot about ISIS. They have two messages on the internet. One is, come to Syria and fight, or kill where you are. Most of these plots in the United States are small scale. A cyber attack would be largely, hugely consequential and with a lot of damage. And that's why most experts, when you ask them what does keep them up, it's this cyberspace world that's completely the new frontier. There are no rules of the game involved in it. The good news is I passed in December the cybersecurity bill that will allow the federal government to share with the private sector and private with private these malicious codes or threat information with liability protection. Why is that important? Because if you can share the codes, you can essentially lock your door so they can't, the intrusions can't come in.
Now let me talk to you about another aspect of this. I'm not sure this might be an area of slight disagreement. I'm a Rand Paul guy on the NSA stuff. I think he's made more compelling to me. Realize it's a close call. Not a Snowden guy, although I think...
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. There might be people in the room that would be surprised. There's a weird vibe with some of this stuff about the government and privacy.
Yeah.
And we get into the issue of encryption. If you can explain what that is and how these guys are able to be in a private chat room, I guess, with ISIS and some of these crazy imams around the world to be, and what we have to do and how that intersects with maybe the damage that Snowden did.
Well, we're always in a, privacy versus security. And I don't think we have to give up on either one. I think we can hit the right balance, and that's what we've tried to do. I think Europe is going through more of a pro-security position because their privacy standards were so much that they couldn't even vet EU citizens past watch lists coming out of Istanbul, for instance. We had the USA Freedom Act, which took metadata, put in the private sector. When I was a federal prosecutor, that's how I used to handle it. I voted for it. So we're always having that debate. Encryption, it's called the dark space. So when Paris, for instance, happened, we had no warning in advance at all. And I knew without even having the briefing that they were communicating in darkness, in the dark space, which is called encryption. And on their iPhones, they have apps, in this case Telegram, where they can communicate that even if we have a court order, or even if it's overseas and you got the NSA trying to see it, we can't see what they're saying. And the threat on this one is that, when you hear there's no specific incredible threat to the United States, the problem is if you can't see what they're saying. So if you have 200,000 of these communications coming out of Iraq or Syria into the United States, and we know that they're talking, but then we can't see what they're saying, as a prosecutor, you usually got a wiretap or a FISA.
Right.
If you can't see what they're saying, you can't stop it. And so,
what do we do? What's the solution?
Well,
for
the FBI, this is the greatest challenge they've seen, and for local law enforcement, too. I don't think a knee-jerk legislative reaction that essentially would put a backdoor in everybody's iPhone that the government could get into is going to be the solution.
I don't think people would stand for it. Yeah, there's a lot of pushback.
I think you'd see a major political blowback, and you open it up to the hackers as well. I think there's a technology solution to this. So Senator Warner and I from Virginia are proposing legislation to form sort of a 9/11 style commission that would have Silicon Valley and the FBI and Homeland, because right now they don't talk to each other about this. They can't coordinate. But if you have Silicon, privacy advocates, Homeland, NSA, intelligence community, all and with a mandate to report to Congress on solutions, I think we can get there. And at the same time, call it digital security. where we can protect the privacy of individuals. I get the idea. I represent Austin. I've got Apple in my district. And, you know, people want an app that's secure, if it's a financial app or a
right.
healthcare app. They don't want people to mm-hmm. be able to get into that. So, I just think there is a solution out there that we haven't thought about.
Let me bring you back to Philadelphia for a moment. We are just passed, and I covered this, so I know how growing and what happened, the security here with the Pope. And you were involved in an interesting thing because I wanted to talk about bipartisan and someone in your position versus, again, members of Congress. Bob Brady, the congressman, kind of came after you because you had information on the Pope or one of these chatter things that we always hear, and he had a sense of why wasn't he told about that. Well, he's not in the intelligence community. You seem to have a lot of backing. Talk about the Pope, too, when he was here. Mm-hmm. And there had to be a million scenarios and threats and wild stuff. And we went through, and I know all the people in the room did, we had quite a discussion on my show, and it comes back to this issue again of security, which we're all for, and then when it became oppressive and almost silly, in my view, of some of the stuff that went on, and it was very difficult for people even to go to a mass here. And it really underlined the tension, because we're national security people, listeners and host, I can speak for Talk Radio 1210, but also we're concerned about kind of silly stuff that seems to be overdone.
Yeah.
Talk about that in the Pope thing. Like, what were you hearing then as far as a lot of threats and the kind of thing that was going on?
There was a threat in Philadelphia that mm-hmm. was stopped.
Right.
And I mentioned that on one of the Sunday shows without, you know, violating.
It right.
wasn't specific. Congressman Brady, who I've never had a disagreement with, you know, on the floor. Apparently, I think it was more of a, hey, I didn't know about that.
Right. right.
It was yeah. one of those things.
Well, he was drinking the holy water of the Pope, too.
He did drink
you're
the
a
holy
Catholic,
water.
Too, so, you know, that's an important
well.
Thing. You didn't get the holy water.
I didn't get it either. It,
right, yeah.
But we are
would
both,
you have?
I probably do the sign of the cross. But we are both Catholic. And
right.
I think that was more of a sort of like, hey, he knows about this and I don't.
Right.
And I'm not being from Philadelphia, I was surprised that the Philadelphia press stuck up for me, even though I don't represent the area.
Right.
It was a tense time, and for a variety of reasons. The Pope Mobile is not armored mm-hmm. like a lot of our secure vehicles are. The Pope, and I particularly like this Pope a great deal, because he is so warm and friendly, mm-hmm. wants to go out in the crowds.
He was in a Fiat, yeah.
And so from a Secret Service,
right.
FBI standpoint, it's like your worst nightmare. Because mm-hmm. you've got, really, you think about it, the Holy Father, the leader of the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. the largest global Christian religion, who is a target of the radical Islamists, right?
Well, talk about that for a minute, would you, before you go forward to, you know, why would they think taking out the Pope? Wouldn't that bring people, don't they think, that's it, finally we're going to get at the heart of how perverted this is, if you kill particularly this Pope?
Well, it'd be a significant victory. I mean, it's a victory for them. I mean, they crucified Christians in Syria.
Right.
So if they can take out the leader of, you know, the largest Christian organization,
mm-hmm.
Why they do a lot of the things they do? I mean, it doesn't make sense to us, but in their mind, the caliphate's gonna grow. They are gonna take over huge swaths of the Middle East and Northern Africa,
mm-hmm.
and to some extent, you can argue they're achieving that under this administration, and mm-hmm. from which they can conduct external operations until we take that out. But the Pope, right. because of his accessibility. And we all respected that, but it was kind of a worst nightmare scenario because number one target, I would argue, and number two is the way he liked to get out in the mail.
Well, when you get briefed on that with the Pope and all, and you put it out there and all this stuff, what else do you do? I mean, what else can you do at your level to sound the alarm on that? What are you doing around that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's part of my oversight. So
right.
I met with Secret Service,
okay.
got the briefing.
Mm-hmm.
How are you going to protect him? I questioned them.
Okay.
You know, what are you doing? What's your plan for the Capitol when he's mm-hmm. in Hawaii? What's your plan for Philadelphia and New York? Just like the Super Bowl, you know, we work with the feds, state and locals on Major sporting events are also, big targets, as we saw in Paris with the soccer stadium. The Pope was, I can't lie, there was a lot of concern about that visit.
Well, we didn't really get a sense of that, so that's something new to actually hear from you.
I think, again, just because of the nature of who he is,
right,
and the target that bullseye he is, and then the way he liked to go out into the masses.
Mm-hmm. Let me give you some of the questions we have for listeners. This is Dr. Marion Mass, who I believe called me today under a pseudonym. Or is a doctor here tonight? Is there a doctor in the house? Okay. Dr. Mass, and we'll take other questions, too, from our listeners that are here. I showed you these, and I told you these are, big-time stuff here as the level of questions she asked. Can you confirm that the terrorists in Paris came from ISIS-infiltrated countries? And then she wants to bank shot that back to the United States. And she asked, what's the big deal with temporarily calling a halt, even if you set a timetable, Congressman, of 3 months or 6 months or whatever it would be? Why is that such a big deal that we can't see the political gridlock break to say, yes, that's the right thing to do?
The nine Paris attackers,
right,
all went to, this is very significant. They're all foreign, what we call foreign fighters. Mm-hmm. They went to Syria, they trained, and then they got back into Europe. Two of them got through the refugee process into Europe. That's the scenario that in a New York or Philadelphia environment, the foreign fighter, we've had hundreds of Americans go over there, and about 50 have come back.
When they come back, they ought to immediately lose their citizenship, go to jail, whatever.
Well,
what prevents that?
Well, we have the Constitution, so if we have predication and there's due process to indict or arrest them, we do. And some of them, we just have to monitor them.
Let me stop you right there,
we don't have sufficient evidence.
Okay, so it's an evidentiary thing. But going there is not evidence.
That's
enough
not a
of
crime.
Itself.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
It's not exactly a crime. It's a tough one. I mean, and you have people going over for humanitarian reasons into Syria. But getting to the Syrian refugee program, that was my bill.
Right.
I thought it was very common sense and a thoughtful bill to say, look, you got a population coming out of the most dangerous part of the world. Raqqa is the capital of ISIS. Now, I get the fact that a lot of them have, whether it's Assad or ISIS, mm-hmm. have been, oppressed. But we have to do this right. And all we said was, look, let's put a pause on this program until we can properly vet them and have that assurance at the highest levels of the federal government and give them FBI background checks. Because right now, when I had the FBI director and secretary of Homeland come before my committee saying, we can't properly vet these individuals.
Would you ever be able to,
take them at their word.
Yeah, would you ever? I remember the FBI director, and again, you have great support from. I think this guy's heroic considering the administration narrative and what he's doing, serving at the pleasure of the president, essentially, in this is amazing. How would we ever vet a lot of these people? There are no records. There's nothing out there that would be able to do it, it seems to me.
Well, we don't have good intelligence on the ground in Syria. And we don't, we pulled our embassy out. Mm-hmm. We don't have very good databases.
Right.
And so we'd have to develop that. But, we put a pause on the Iraqi refugee program for 6 months before we started to let them in. And by the way, there have been multiple Iraqi refugees now that basically became radicalized and either were terrorists over there mm-hmm. or became terrorists in the United States. And that's where we had far better intelligence. I just think, my first priority is to protect the American people. And if I see a threat, and if I can do something to stop that, I'm going to try to stop it.
Absolutely. I think you're doing a hell of a job, and I think the book speaks to that. Let me go back to the book and talk about some of the bigger picture threats that you went into. We talked about all these probable scenarios, but North Korea. And it just seems to me we're living in an era, the dilemma is a country that can't feed its own people, yet has enough smart people and resources that they can develop nuclear weapons, be in the cyber attack mode. It is an amazing, I was offered once a chance to go to North Korea. I declined. Have you been there?
No. No, okay. They wouldn't let me in.
No, okay. It was a congressman. I thought 10 days in North Korea is not exactly a pick. Camden's right here.
Russia was bad enough.
Right, yeah, I'd rather go to Camden. Well, yeah. So North Korea is a particular dilemma because once they get a nuclear weapon, and this is the Iranian dilemma, then there's nothing you really can do effectively, it would seem to me. But what do you say about that?
Well, Vice President Cheney told me that the biggest mistake he made was negotiating with North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And he predicted that the same thing will happen with Iran. We passed the sanctions to dismantle their nuclear program,
right?
Not to allow it to go forward. I met with Prime Minister Netanyahu in Israel last May before the Iran deal. Obviously, he's very concerned about it, as is Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. And the $100 to $150 billion that will be infused into their economy and bankroll terrorism, because they're the number one sponsor of terrorism. Not to mention the ICBM capabilities that we, when I asked Secretary Kerry, why aren't you negotiating that as well? Mm-hmm. Because they're only built for one reason, that's to deliver a nuclear warhead intercontinental, that means across continents. And the Ayatollah says we will move forward with that capability full steam ahead. They've demonstrated they can't be trusted very well, to say the least. The inspection and verification process that's been set up was not really to my satisfaction that it could be done right. There are these secret deals between the IAEA and Iran that we were not given access to. And when I asked Secretary Kerry on foreign affairs if he had seen that, he said, no, I've been briefed on it, though. So even he hasn't seen. So you got the verification, the infusion of money, the ICBM, and the potential, I mean, the ability for them to move forward with their nuclear program.
One more on the big level, and I want to ask a couple more listener questions. You talk about Putin in the book. You got to put Putin in the book if you're talking about things like this.
Yeah.
President Bush, I mean, I liked a lot of things, but when he said he looked into Putin, he saw his soul. I don't know if that was shirtless or not.
It
was a dark soul there, yes. They were somewhere when he did that. And you have a startling scenario in the book of how far this guy, he's inching, but then he might go afoot, pushing into the Baltic states. Mm-hmm. And then you have material in there about then Russian subs surfacing off of Sarasota, off Florida, off of Disney again, places like that. This guy strikes me that this is what he's determined to do, inch by inch. Maybe one time he'll go more than an inch with some of these scenarios.
Well, you know, once KGB, always KGB.
Right.
And his eyes are probably very dark. He's an interesting character. He's a very machismo kind of guy. You're right, without the shirt on the horse. And so his whole, and my wife used to track Soviet submarines, believe it or not, in the Cold War. And I met her at the Air and Space Museum, and she told me, I've never dated somebody that tracks Soviet submarines.
This is an interesting family dynamic here, without a doubt, yeah.
But the point is, after the Cold War, they left the submarines. Right. Now they are back. They are off the coast of the United States. Why is that important? Because submarines deliver nuclear warheads.
Mm-hmm.
Putin, his whole, I think, vision is to restore the greatness of the Soviet Empire. He views Gorbachev as a betrayal to Russia. And so he wants to restore the Soviet Empire. We saw it in Crimea, and this is the Crimean model, is you take Russian-speaking peoples and you have them, through manipulation, say they want to be part of Russia, and you bring them in. Ukraine is going through the same problem right now, and yet this administration won't arm the Ukraine to defend itself. And all the Baltic states are potentially a victim now of this aggression, this Russian aggression, to take back the Baltic states, Ukraine, and restore the greatness of the former Soviet Union. This is met back home politically. Mr. Putin has this great nationalistic pride going and is met with great popularity by the Russian people because they feel like they've been sort of slapped down. And now he's restoring their greatness. This scenario is a very, very likely scenario unless we stand up to it. You know, I talk about the axioms in here. Weakness invites aggression. Peace through strength. Kyle-Lisa Rice told me, you want them to like you, but if not, respect you, and if not respect you, to fear you.
It's a Ronald Reagan textbook. He should have written the foreword. I think you're wearing something tonight from that. Common sense from that.
And we have none of that today. And that's, we're not leading as a superpower. The generation my dad fought for and handed down a better America to mine, mm-hmm. and the greatness that we became a superpower, we're not leading as a superpower. We defeated fascism.
FDR defeated fascism. And Reagan
and
defeated communism.
Reagan and Kennedy. And now we have Islamist extremism, and we have Putin, who's now in the region, by the way. Now Russia's in Syria, complicating the issue with Assad, which if he's there, as long as he's there, we'll never be able to fix this.
Well, let me get into the presidential debate that's going on, commander-in-chief and that kind of thing. And a listener asked, what do you think of Donald Trump? So I'll let you respond. This is the listener question.
Well,
and any of the presidential candidates and their stance on this, you are a guy whose endorsement, I think, would be highly prized. I don't know if you'll do that at some point or not in this. And I think the discussions at times have been really good in the debate on national security, not so much on the Democrat side. They're more on economic issues. But do you have thoughts on, because they really are differing. Trump seems to say, look, I can deal with the Putin. I'm a deal maker. You can make deals with these guys.
I mean, it's a number one issue. And when the Democrats were asked, all three of them, what are your top three priorities?
Climate.
Yeah. Well, it didn't even come up.
Yeah.
At all. And so, you know, I think any of our guys would be better than, or gal, than any of those three. Trump, well, I mean, he could probably look at Putin in the eye and stare him down, you know? I would have to say. There's some things that
Have you met Trump?
Yeah, I sent this book to all the candidates, by the way. And
Give us the response.
And
what
I've had
they
several,
say?
Well, they've called me, hey, thanks for your book.
Right,
and
right.
Want the advice and all that. And of course, endorsement. I've stayed out for
right.
now. I want a commander-in-chief that can restore the greatness of America. That's, I want the Reagan. This is like we're in Carter land right now.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me so much when I was in college with my good friend Tom Fisher here, and we had Carter in office, and we were demoralized as a nation, and Reagan came back and restored the greatness. And that, Trump does talk about that a lot. Some of his remarks are a little, controversial, but people like that. They like the fact he's not politically correct. I think that he is tapping, whether you like him or not, he's tapping into something out there, and it's a populist conservative movement, just like Bernie Sanders is tapping into a populist liberal population, I think. And the question is, how far is this movement? This isn't traditional Republican politics anymore. I've never seen anything like this in my lifetime. It's defying, and Trump is defying all the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And including, if I insulted Megyn Kelly, I'm out. I've lost my job back home. But somehow, he gets away with it.
She's a big fan. She's endorsed the book. She's done all that stuff,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, she was on her show, and she likes my book. But he really defies a lot of the conventional political Republican rules, and maybe that's why some people like him.
Marco Rubio seems to me, the one time we had him here in town, both the charisma, but knowledgeable, extremely knowledgeable. I'm not sure domestically, but on national security he is. Have you done anything with him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think he is probably, he's incredibly smart. I think he's one of best versed candidates on national security. I agree with probably 99% of what he talks about, and I want a candidate that agrees with my recommendations. I would say Bush, I don't know if he's got a chance. He has no traction at all, but he does have around him some of the top military advisors who I respect a great deal, like General Hayden, who endorsed my book, and many others. And that's going to be the most important thing for the next commander-in-chief is how to deal with the military and the threats, out there. But I haven't, I don't know. This is, it's a crazy election. And if Trump steamrolls Iowa and New Hampshire, he could, you can see a path.
Well, I hope that it gets to Pennsylvania for once. So that's my rooting.
You and I both agree. Iowa shouldn't have a stronghold over this.
Good. I want that endorsement tonight. I want that on camera, too. We both agree with this. We've both been to Iowa. We've seen 6 electoral votes, and these people kicked the tires forever. They're still doing it tonight, determining who will really have momentum coming out of this. What have you thought about the debates, though, and national security, the issues coming up? Would you like to see, I'd like to see somebody throw in some of the scenarios from this book, because I think they're interesting to the average person in addition to how important these are.
Yeah, I mean, again, these are red team exercises. We talk about stuff like this in my hearings all the time. I was preparing myself for the attack that I'm, providing a playbook or whatever. It's nothing they haven't thought of. I would like them to talk about, the more fact-based parts of my book and the solutions. I do think it's going to be one of the most important issues in this election. And I'd like it to be a point of discussion.
Let me give you another question from a listener. Ruth had this one. Why is Congress not defunding the Obama administration's attempts to bring inadequately vetted Muslim Syrians and other Muslim Middle Easterns into America, where France and Germany both have had terrorist incidents, respectively, from some of the recent emigres? And boy, some of the stories, even Sweden, Denmark, these people are getting tough. When you're in the Scandinavian states and they are cracking down, and some of their Le Pen, I guess it is, in France, some places like this that seem to be much more libertine than we are cracking down, you would think, what is it in Congress that is not propelling some of those measures?
Well, you talk just about Europe first. I mean, you have 500,000 Syrian refugees in Europe, and I've talked to a lot of the ambassadors and leaders from the European nations, they're very worried about this. And a lot of them, they're not mothers and children, they're military-age males, and that concerns them. And it's very polarized in Europe. They don't integrate. They have the diasporas. The Muslim community is not integrated as well as it is in the United States. They have a serious problem on their hands, and they're wide open because of their privacy laws, not allowing for security to vet past watch lists, again, things like that, or share information between other European nations in this free Schengen zone where they can travel freely without showing any documentation. Europol just came out yesterday announcing that there is a major plot and threat against Europe, and particularly against the United Kingdom. They're going to get hit again because they're so wide open. I don't want to see that happen here. I think we're a little bit safer. We don't have as many foreign fighters. We're talking about 10,000 Syrians that I've tried to block, but the administration is just hell-bent on bringing them in.
And your Democrat colleagues, you seem like a guy who can reach across the aisle, talk to these people. You do it on a daily basis. Don't they back this? Don't they say,
well, come on,
hearing us?
My bill, we passed it in a bipartisan way.
Right.
Because Democrats actually trust me. They have some credibility with them. We had enough votes to override a presidential veto. And then Harry Reid would not allow the vote to come to the Senate floor on the Syrian refugee.
Mm-hmm. What can we do about Harry Reid while you're here? I mean, it seems to be, it's got to be a bill, the Harry Reid bill, that he goes back to the fig plants, the fig trees that he likes in Nevada.
And I have people in my own party, they get mad at me, and I have to explain it's the Senate and the 60 vote rule, and why can't they change it? Why don't we change that on the Iran vote of all things, And what we hear from the senators as well, it's a tradition of the Senate. Well, I don't think people really care
about
the
If Iran gets a nuclear weapon, there are not going to be too
Who
many
cares
traditions.
Cares about the traditions.
Exactly.
And that's where a lot of us in the House.
Right.
We're elected every 2 years. So we're more on the pulse of the people. They elected every 6. They talk about the cooling off process and all that. And you can't get anything done. I get very frustrated. It's hard to get things done. And in my world, if I can't get something done, that means you're more in danger.
I have to tell you, talking with the congressman in the green room and sharing this, I feel blessed that we're able to bring him to Philadelphia and what capable hands we're in. And some people are back there with him, and I hope you got a sense of that tonight. I wanted to ask you, from the book, what is it that you want our listeners that are here tonight, and I'll say tomorrow morning, that is the part of the book you really enjoyed writing or has the most impact, the area that you really put a lot into?
You know, each chapter is very unique. I think they wanted me to pick a case that I prosecuted in the Justice Department. Mm-hmm. And I picked the Johnny Chung case, which led us to the director of Chinese intelligence, who was funneling money into the Clinton campaign.
The coffees with Johnny Chung.
And yeah. Precisely. And all the craziness, including my FBI agent in L.A. getting indicted for espionage because he's sleeping with the enemy, with a Chinese
wow.
spy. Crazy. And you can't make this up, and it actually happened. But I think the takeaway, I mean, each chapter is very different. Has a special, you know, an educational process to it, but I think the introduction and the closing, really, I lay out the vision, talk about my dad, that generation, you know, fascism, communism, mm-hmm. the threat today, because I look at my kids and what are we handing down to them? Is this idea? It's a struggle of ideology. We need a counter narrative. This is a counter narrative to the administration's failed policies. That's what this book is. And I end it with this won't end in my lifetime. And it probably won't end in my children's. I hope it does. But I do hope that one day, and as I visited Iraq, they showed me this structure. It was Abraham's house. And I thought, you know, out of that house, the three major
right.
religions. And the idea that maybe one day, maybe these three religions could exist peacefully. Now, I don't know if that's possible. And that's kind of the way it ends is, you know, that's a great hope that we all have, right? But is that really possible as long as you have a very backward 6th century AD movement, and that's what ISIS is, using modern day technology?
It's a nightmare, but would you accept Homeland Security in the Republican administration?
Oh,
is that a goal
yeah.
for you? Is that something?
I'd rather be National Security Advisor. But
all right. Well, we'll take that up if we have the candidates in.
I think I would. I guess, you know, I'd have to build a big, beautiful wall if it was Trump, right?
So, way to bring it all home together. Congressman Mike McCaul here tonight, folks. Thanks for joining us with him.